This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, the podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. In this episode, rural community nurse Jeanette McDonald talks about her job caring for patients in rural communities.
My name's Jeanette McDonald, and I'm a rural community registered nurse for Hospice Waikato. And so my job entails a lot of driving. I travel out to various towns and rural communities to see patients in their homes and work with the patients and their families, looking at symptom management, if they're needing any support from our family support team, like counselling or social workers. I liaise with the doctors in the towns, with our doctors, with the hospital and the district nurses.
So you live at Te Mero in the Cambridge district, but you travelled to Morrinsville?
Morrinsville, Te Araha, Pairoa. I've travelled to just about all the places around here with various aspects of my job. I've moved areas every now and then, you know, just when it's been time to do so.
And you're visiting people in their homes. So I take it, because you're a rural nurse, it's small rural communities and people on farms?
Yeah, people on farms, people in little towns dotted around the Waikato. I love my job. I love going out and seeing patients and families. And it's not just about the patient, you know, it's about everybody involved, because it's not just, you know, you can't look after a person really on your own if you're, you know, a family member. You really need to have a lot of support around you to be able to do that.
When did you take on the work of a palliative care nurse, Jeanette?
Probably about 18 years ago. But before that, I was always interested in doing that for a long time, and I'd also had a lot of experience around people dying. When I was growing up, I grew up on a farm. We moved around a lot for a start until my dad was able to afford to buy the farm with his well drilling job. But once we were sort of established there, we're on a farm, and so my parents were pretty amazing around life and death and animals. You know, we'd see animals die and get born and all of that. So they were really good at making us aware of everything that goes on in life, and also because we lived very isolated in a rural community, way out in the bush, we didn't get a lot of visitors, but they always invited people who did come and stay with us quite a lot. So we got quite a wide range of people, family and friends, coming to get a broad range of how to live, how life was, you know. So, but one thing about my dad was, like, if he had to kill a sheep, and we were there, he didn't like killing animals, but, you know, we needed that for food. But he would always explain to us about the organs and the this and the that, you know. So we were, like, I've always loved the human body and what it can do in the human psyche. And I was never afraid of death, really. And my grandmother died when I was 17, when I just started nursing. She got the Asian flu, and in those days, when people got those types of flus, there was nothing you could do about it. And we went to see my grandmother on the way to a family celebration, and I only found out when we got there that she was so sick that the doctor had just been and said that she was dying. And before they'd said that, I could see that she was dying. And there was nothing you could do, and it was like it was her time, you know. And I really loved her. Like, she was an amazing grandmother. I used to go and stay with her a lot. And it was, for me, it was like, why am I not, like, I was sad, you know, I was worried about her dying a little bit, but I kind of knew that it was going to happen, so, and that it was natural for her, you know. I know that sounds a bit weird, But yeah, it kind of set me up to not be afraid of dying or death. I don't know how else to say it, but.
So what drew you to nursing? Like, you did explain about your fascination, but you always knew that nursing was going to be your...
No, I didn't actually. I thought I wanted to be an artist. My parents said, oh, you can't be an artist. You need to go and, you know, get a proper job. So nursing, well, I actually was quite keen on nursing anyway, because we had a beautiful encyclopedia when I was a kid that had diagrams of the eye and, you know, things like that. So I used to pore over those. I really loved looking at the anatomy and the physiology of the body and things like that. So,
what kind of artist did you want to be?
Well, I actually did become an artist in the end. Multimedia kind of sculptural works, big boats and things made out of supplejack cane and and lots of other stuff.
And you still do that today?
I haven't had as much time in the last quite a number of years because of this job. But I do love to, I do a little bit of that still.
So where did you first go nursing?
I did my training at Rotorua Public Hospital in the old-fashioned way, so that you were trained, you did 6 weeks of study, and then you were trained on the wards. You actually went and did the physical work, which was amazing because it became just second nature to you rather than, I know some people find it really hard these days doing all the sort of university work and they only get certain placements for very short periods of time. It's the opposite way around. And so they can be a little bit feeling at a disadvantage, I've learnt from some nurses, when they start actually going and doing the actual, get registered and going doing their full nursing.
So you were sort of learning on the job?
We were learning on the job as well. And we had wonderful older nurses, the year ahead of us or 6 months ahead of us who were great mentors for us as well. So, and we lived in a nurse's home, which you never have these days. And so that was a great way of teaching you how to be with other people in a community like that and be able to get on with people and resolve differences and things like that, so that was about 3.5 years doing that.
And when you've finished and you graduated?
Yeah, I worked there for another year as a staff nurse. In Burns Ward and in ED and medical and I worked in a few different wards. Yeah.
And a Burns Ward that must have been.
Well, it was part of the surgical ward. It was horrible actually because in those days we didn't have many ways to support people with burns and we had one man come in who had fallen into a hot pool when he was working on power lines. And I think it was 80% of his body was burnt. And it was just so awful trying to nurse the man to keep him pain-free, because he couldn't move at all, and wrapping him in cloths and everything to keep everything moist so he could move. But he did have a very difficult dying, because 80% burns, maybe they can deal with it nowadays with the gels and things that they use, but that was awful.
So how did you cope with that?
Just going and being with him, just there wasn't a lot you could say or do. Just being with him really was probably the most important thing for him. Not being alone, it was shocking. It's very shocking to have someone die like that.
Do you ever get used to things like that?
You probably don't ever get used to them, but you learn to deal with them,
So what happens after Rotorua?
I went overseas and nursed in hospitals in London, for most of the main hospitals and private hospitals as well, and I loved doing that. Worked in private homes too, and sort of saved money to go and travel and things like that, so that was a great experience. And just recently I went to the UK again for the first time in 50 years since that time, and went back to St Thomas's, which is just about all, it's all brand new now, so, but they had the Florence Nightingale Museum there, so we went to that, her starting out with nursing way back in the 1800s.
So you never regretted going into nursing?
No, not at all, and I've been able to make art whenever I want to as well, so, got both wills.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned before we got started that you lost your husband a while back.
Mm.
So I presume you got married. Did you
have I got married. I had children. I came. We lived on a farm out near the coast. And I was married for 20 years. And then we did get divorced. But about 5 years later, he died in a tractor accident, which was really traumatic for both my kids and for the family and for me as well. Yeah.
It's every farmer's nightmare.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah, and yeah, it was such a freak sort of an accident as well.
So when you got divorced, did you go? Were you still nursing, or did you go back to nursing?
I went back to nursing. Yeah, I went back to nursing, and really found that interesting and enjoyed it. I worked. I worked in, for an agency for a while. And said, I don't know how great I'll be because, you know, I haven't nursed for quite a while, though I had done a back-to-nursing course and things. And they said, don't worry about it. We are going to, we'll go out with you for a first few days and see how you do. And I went to a small rural hospital, aged care, and worked there. And it was a wonderful getting back on the bandwagon for nursing, really. They really supported me well. You know, a lot of people think agency nurses are sort of just, that the agency just uses you. Some people think like that, but I found that they were an amazing agency back in that time. You know, really supported the nurses to come up to scratch.
There would have been a lot of changes in that time between you getting married and raising a family and going back to nursing. Then.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of new technologies would have come in.
Yeah, that's right. But basic nursing never changes.
What's basic nursing?
It's actually what I call it, loving your patient. But most people wouldn't use the word love. But what I mean by that is actually connecting with the person. And, medicine these days, you know, so even with palliative care, it's getting much more medicalised. And... But the basic thing is, you know, good old-fashioned washing people, supporting them to mobilise, you know, making sure they're eating, all of that. That doesn't always happen a lot nowadays.
That's interesting. So you're saying palliative care is becoming more medicalised. What does that mean?
There's more and more... we've got people who are getting more... Like when I was way back, when I first started nursing, cancer was... It was there, but, you know, you didn't get that many cancer patients in hospital. Nowadays you get a huge amount more, but also back then they might have one type of thing, one cancer, one, you know, whatever. But nowadays people have multi things. You know, they might have cancers, but they might also have chronic respiratory disease and diabetes and heart failure and, you know, all sorts of things as well as their cancer. Well, they might have several different kinds of cancer. And also, a lot of those people have got much more complex pain issues as well because of all of that, and not just complex pain issues. So their life is kind of totally kind of turned around, so there's lots of more psychosocial things that need to be addressed as well, you know. And so, we're getting more and more people with lots and lots of things on their diagnosis list rather than one or two. And that's quite shocking to me. It's quite kind of, gosh, you know, how's this happened? And I remember reading something quite a few years ago from the World Health Organization that said that something like 80-something percent of all illness and disease is reversible. It just depends on lifestyle and things like that. And so... you sort of think, gosh, you know, what are we living like now, you know, for us to have all of that happening to us? I've forgotten what your question was. So.
I'm just the medicalisation of palliative care.
Yeah, and that's a great thing in some ways because we've got more ways of supporting people now. But I think sometimes too we kind of, in the Western world at least, tend to think that we're never going to die and that we don't want to think about it or talk about it. And But we all, nobody can escape that, you know. And so...
Your way, you did mention earlier, you know, about loving your patient.
Mm.
So your worldview is one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast series is because in Western society we are very much removed from death.
Yes.
It's something that happens behind closed doors and we're often very afraid to talk about it.
Mm. That's true, very afraid.
A friend of mine just went into hospice care and when I mentioned this to other friends, their first response is, "Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that."
Mm.
Whereas my reaction was quite different. I knew he was sick and I knew it was going to happen at some stage. And when we spoke, he said, it's time. He said, "I'm just sick of being unwell and going in and out of hospital." And he said, "I'm ready to go." And, you know, while you feel, I wouldn't say I'm grieving. I did cry when I was with him, but yes. It was just more about love, you know,
and
emotions welling up.
Yes, and also, you know, to feel someone who's willing to accept where they're at. But I always feel they have a simpler death somehow because, and a simpler path to that as well because, you know, a lot of people fight cancer and they're not going to give up and it's like, you're not giving up, you're actually just surrendering to what is at the moment. And that might just simply be that you've got... you know, some pain that we haven't been able to get on top of, or you might have some nausea and vomiting. And that's what's happening at the moment. It doesn't mean to say it's going to be happening all the time, you know. But we often, I know a lot of people think they might get a couple of symptoms that are a bit more intense than usual, and they think, oh, I'm dying now, you know, because they haven't been able to, or educated about, you know, what happens, you know, the pathway.
The process of dying.
Yeah.
That's interesting what you said because I said to him, he said to me when we were having this conversation, and you'll hear this podcast at Costa and Hospice, would be part of this podcast series,
mm-hmm.
When he got his diagnosis of cancer in 2015, he said, I didn't fight it. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, I just accepted it and I got on with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And he had 10 years.
Yes.
He had 10 years in remission.
That's amazing.
And he said, I do meet people who say, oh, I hope you're fighting it and I hope you're going to get that bastard and knock it to the ground. Mm. And he said, no, not at all. I'm not going to even dwell on it.
No.
I'm just going to do the best I can with what I've got until it gets me.
I had a man say to me the other day, new patient, now, this is what I don't want. He said, I don't want anybody to tell me what my life expectancy is. And I said, good for you. You know, because he said, I just want to get on with it. And we're all going to die, he said, you know. But who knows whether that's by a heart attack or by this cancer, but I just want to get on with it.
Well, that's what surprised me about Costa. He's still a relatively young man. He's 68. And he's still got a lot ahead. You know, still have a good 20 years ahead. And I wondered how he felt about that. And it is what it is. We're not going to spend my last weeks or days dwelling in regrets or what might have been or what might be.
Yeah. I sometimes say to people, you know, you might have been told a diagnosis and this is with people often who are frightened and all they can think of is they've only got 3 months in January so-and-so, that's, I'll be gone, you know. And it's like, well, actually, none of us actually know when you're going to die. You know, even us as Baptist clinicians and that, we can often get it wrong.
It's not a precise
It's not a precise thing, no, at all. And it depends on many factors. And so I often say, you know, whether your diagnosis is a year or 6 months or three months or 2 weeks, you know, your prognosis, I should say, if you keep thinking there to the end, what about this bit in between? All of that, that's life to be lived. Don't waste that by be thinking you're already there, you know, at the end of it. Does that make sense?
Is it possible that people might even talk themselves into that?
Some people, I have had someone who's died pretty much exactly at the time, but they wouldn't accept any support in any way either. They would They wouldn't accept pain management or anything like that. They just thought, I'm dying, and that they just wanted to get it over with. It was sad because, yeah.
Did the person suffer from pain?
They did have some pain, and emotional pain too, but they wouldn't want to talk to anybody about it.
Yeah. So when did you find yourself in palliative care, nursing, Jeanette?
I came back from Australia about 20-something years ago, and I was working in Tauranga, and I worked at an aged care home there, got a job there, and they did palliative care very well in that rest home. And the nurse manager there, she was an incredible woman, really awesome, really loved her patients, really wanted great care for them, and was very onto it. You know, I learnt a lot from her. I just loved her. She was amazing. She's a good friend now. but I had always wanted to do hospice nursing as well, but hadn't really had an opportunity.
Why had you always wanted to do hospice nursing?
I don't know. It just...
It appealed?
Well, it's not so much it appeals. It's just that there's more interaction with the patient and with the families and things like that. It's not just an isolated thing. Like, I've never particularly liked working in a hospital situation. Really, I just love being out and about with people. I did work in the inpatient unit there for a while as well, just till I got a job there as a community nurse. And it's quite a different way of working there to here, because we were doing all the pumps, we were doing all the dressings and de-accessing ports when people have chemotherapy and things like that. So I did that for 11 and a half years there, loved it. Loved the people I worked with, because that's one of the things about hospice people, you know, the people who work in hospices. They have purpose, you know, they're really purposeful about what they're doing. They love people, they want people not to suffer, you know. They want for people to be able to have a good, you know, it says a good death, but, you know, even the word good feels a bit trite in a way. A meaningful death, possibly, might be a better way of putting it, where they're safe and they're comfortable and all of that. And it doesn't always work like that, because some people don't have that, but, you know, you do your best to make sure that it's as comfortable and as true for them as they want it to be.
Yeah. Just to sidestep for a second, my friend Costa, mm-hmm. when I was speaking to him, interviewing him for this podcast series, he'd just had that morning he'd been clean shaven, mm-hmm. Somebody came in and shaved him, somebody came in and changed his nappies. Mm-hmm. Now, his wife spoke about you get to a complete loss of dignity, mm-hmm. and then it doesn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. So he's a grown man having his nappies changed and mm-hmm. his bottom wiped and cleaned mm-hmm. up, and then somebody else comes in and then massages his, because he can't walk anymore, yeah. so his legs are massaged. Mm-hmm. And my first thought when this was all being described to me was that, well, I couldn't do that. I couldn't wipe somebody's bottom. I couldn't mm. touch somebody's legs and massage them mm. or shave them. I would find that very, very difficult.
But that's not your design, is it? Your design is this.
Yes. So,
interviewing people.
But people who can do that, you know, yes. hats off to them.
Yes. And
that's hospice people, isn't it?
That's right. And then caregivers who come in and that aren't actually hospice, you know, they're not part of hospice, they're sent by agency and things like that. You know, those people are all totally, it's super important as well, you know. It's a massive thing, really.
So, you're doing a lot of driving, you're out and about mm. every day. Mm. You're visiting farms, mm-hmm. families on farms.
Yeah, some farms.
And how does a farmer cope with?
Sometimes not that easily. Sometimes there's a lot of pride and dignity around having always been the strong one, you know, being able to get out and do everything and not have to ask for help. And that can be quite hard for a lot of people. These big, strong men who are now kind of dependent on their wives and on family members and not liking it. that happens.
So how do they resolve that?
Well, we've got a beautiful family support team here. We can get involved. And a lot of people will say no to counselling. You know, oh no, I don't need that. You know, I talk to my wife or something like that. So it can be quite a trick sometimes to get them to realise that it would be lovely just to have someone neutral to talk to about things you might want to talk to your family about, or maybe that you do want to talk to them about but you don't know how to, and get support to be able to do that.
You know, when my father died a couple of years ago, he was being cared for by hospice at home on the farm,
mm-hmm.
and we were offered counselling, and our response was, oh, we don't need that.
Yeah, most people say that.
And
it's a real trick.
Now knowing what I know now,
mm.
I regret that decision, because in my other job, collecting oral histories, I've learnt that listening to people, just talk, and once they realise that you're listening to them.
That's the biggest thing, the biggest thing.
And they really do start to talk.
Yeah.
And then they just start letting it all out, because they suddenly realise, oh, this person's actually listening.
Mm.
And they're not offering me anything.
Yes.
They're just listening.
That's the beauty of it.
And then at the end of it, they're so grateful.
Mm.
Counselling is a complex word, but it's really not about counselling. It's just about having somebody to hear you.
Exactly. To be heard. All we want is to be heard, loved and appreciated, really. And, that's when I said about loving your patient. To me, that's what it's about. It's giving them the opportunity to be heard, making them realise that they're not just their diagnosis, they're actually a human being sitting in that bed with a life, you know, that may not be what it was once, but was totally valid for them. That's equally as important. And I've just been on overseas for 7 weeks. First time I've had such a long holiday in my life. But I also did a palliative care tour throughout the UK and went to hospices and universities and things like that around palliative care. And what I discovered doing that was, the beauty of it was the people in all the hospices we went to and all the people that were involved in the different things we went to discuss about palliative care, they're all the same. Worldwide, you know, they've all got the same values and same attitudes and wants and needs for the patients and their families to be supported. And we actually met one of the doctors who runs two hospices in London, and she came and had dinner with us one night, and we had a massive talk with her about things. And she also said that it worries her that hospices are becoming more medicalised. I mean, you do need to do it, because that's what's presenting, you know. There's more complex cases now, so you have to look at all that. But she's very much an advocate for, everyone at hospice really, is for the whole person to be taken into account, so that you're not, you know, a lot of people's pain can be psychosocial and emotional and, you know, existential and all of that. And sometimes when you deal with that, their physical pain can lessen without kind of overdoing it with the medications and things. Not that we overdo it, because we're very cautious about how we medicate people.
Costa said two very interesting things. He said one of the benefits of dying in hospice is that people don't tell you how wonderful you are after you've gone. They come to see you. And they tell you then. They tell you everything they feel right there to your face.
Absolutely.
And he said the other thing is, he said, my ex-wife, I hurt her very, very badly.
Mm.
And he said that's been a festering sore for 20 years.
Mm.
And she came in and saw me, and we were able to resolve those emotions.
Isn't that gorgeous?
And put it all to bed.
Mm.
But I have heard other stories, recording this series, of people who never... Who won't do that. They will sit on that emotional pain, and they will...
They take it with them.
They will take it with them, and they won't... They will fight any idea of resolution.
Yeah. Because it's quite hard to be that vulnerable, isn't it? A lot of the time.
It's extremely hard to be vulnerable, especially in New Zealand, where we're not...
Very true.
Our culture is not about... Our culture is about being strong.
Yeah. Or hard or tough.
Yes.
And I've often had men who apologise to me for crying, you know, when things are not great for them and things, and as patients. And I've said, never apologise for crying, because, you know, men, boys and girls, when they're, you know, kids, when they're born equally the same. Whether you're a boy or a girl, you're vulnerable. You rely on other people to support you. And yet, as we grow, and tender and gorgeous and loving, you know, they're just love, aren't they, babies? But then as we go through life, you know, with our families and then going to school and our culture and all of that, that kind of gradually gets put away in a little suitcase somewhere about your person, and the putting on the, you know, the tough guy or the guy who can play rugby and not cry or when he's hurt and that sort of thing gets put in its place. And I feel that's so sad, because we're all tender and vulnerable underneath. We all need to feel that, like, we could be able to say something about it, but we can't in this country.
Being vulnerable, once you understand that you can be vulnerable, and the world doesn't end, it's a release.
It is. It's an amazing release. And I do know men who do express themselves like that. And I just adore them, because they haven't got the complexity of... And they were like that. Like, I've got a couple of friends who were very tough and staunch, and you got to be, you know, the hard man. You can't show any feelings. But I can see how hard it is for... And those men have actually said, all that time I spend in my life hiding myself away so I wouldn't get hurt, but I was actually getting hurt far more, you know, by being hardened. And, you know, our bodies do go hard, you know, when we're kind of bottling things up or hiding them away. And I've done a lot of training around connective tissue in the human body, and how when we over-exercise or when we have a lot of emotional strain or various things like that, we harden in our body, and our connective tissue, which is everywhere throughout our body, gets all dry and stringy. There's actually a little video you can see. You probably wouldn't want to look at it, but yeah, they did a little probe under the skin to see how the connective tissue works. And it's the most beautiful network of lines of tissue, like tissue. And there's fluid running along, little drops of fluid running in all directions along those. That's normal connective tissue. But when we've over-hardened our bodies, whether it's through physical activity or emotional pain or those sorts of things, that kind of dries out and shuts down. And so that's why, you know, you can have pain from just rigidity some of the time. And so the connective tissue work that I've done, you actually just do very gentle movements with people's bodies, which helps to loosen that up and help the body to remember what it's supposed to feel like. that can make a huge difference to people.
Do they do palliative care differently in the UK than we do here?
They've got hospices that are privately, you know, they might be funded only 20%, which is quite a lot less than what I think I can't remember what our percentage is.
About 50%.
50, I think, yeah. So most of those are 20% in the UK, and the rest is fundraising. And they tend to have a lot of shops. But they've also got cafes in their hospices now, so that they can, for several purposes, to raise money, you know, raise funds, but also for local people in the district, you know, where that hospice is, to be able to know there's a cafe there and they can come and go as they please, so they start to get more attuned with what's actually true about hospice and less fear around it.
I think it's a wonderful idea.
I think it's amazing.
Before I volunteered to do this podcast, I had, all I knew about hospice was that was the place you went to die, and every time I drove down Cobham Drive and went past hospice, I was going, that's where you go to die. And then you come here and you realise it's not what
you
imagine.
It's not that. You come here to actually be supported to live as well as you possibly can.
And you get looked after. And
you do.
And you sort of imagine it's all shrouded in gloom. In fact,
no.
It's quite the opposite
of actually, that. I have a lot of fun in my job. I have a lot of joy in my job. We laugh a lot, the people I go and visit. You know, we should not be thinking of death as gloomy. We're all going to have it. And if we were educated and we let ourselves be open to the fact that there's more to dying than just pain, and you know, that people just immediately think pain and then you die and you're suffering. You don't have to suffer. You don't have to suffer.
I interviewed Dr. Catherine Mannix for this podcast.
Oh, did you? Yes.
And she had lots of interesting things to say. First of all, she scolded our government.
Yes.
Just saying,
I'm glad she did.
Austerity
I think she's,
is ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. It is ridiculous.
And the little...
Might have to edit that out.
No, because others in this particular, in the second series have said the same, especially with children's palliative care, the way the funding's been changed and they've made it harder and made it more difficult. And you've got to wonder at that mindset, that accountants, that parsimonious accountant's attitude it doesn't make things easier at all.
No. It actually complicates things, really, really does.
You wonder at the lack of insight in this, in that system. But the other thing she had to say was how deeply impressed she was by Maori culture, and how she said how much Western culture, Western white culture, has got to learn from Maori about caring for people in death.
Yes,
it's not Maori's don't put dying people behind a closed door.
No, definitely not.
The whole family gathers around and.
Yeah. And they're supported, yeah, definitely.
I think we're learning bit by bit. I think Pākehā
it is changing. It is changing. People are becoming more kind of aware about that. But there's a long way to go for that to happen. Yeah.
So you get a phone call, say a farmer somewhere in the Morrinsville district has been diagnosed with terminal cancer. What do you do? You're on the way to their house. What's the first thing that you do?
I don't really know what I do. I just go. The first, what do? I just go and meet them. And usually it's not just on their own. I like there to be someone else with them because people need more than one pair of ears when they're having discussions about their health and their dying as well.
So there'll be a spouse with them?
Yeah, usually.
And a child.
Or maybe someone else, maybe other family members might be there, like, you know, daughters and sons or whatever. I think it's really important to have extra pair of ears because when you're diagnosed and then you're going through all that, you might still be going through some treatment. You might be just coming to terms with the fact that now you're with hospice and all that means you die, you know, you're going to die. You know, you have to go into hospice. A lot of people think you have to go into hospice at the end of your life when, of course, you don't. We do our best to nurse people in their homes. But to just go in and just find a common ground with each other first, I think, is the most important thing. You know, they might have lived somewhere where I've lived. You know, I might ask where they, you know, about their life and things. Sort of to get that as well. But also, what to them is the most, what is concerning them the most right now? That's probably the most important question.
And what is often concerning them the most?
Well, it varies a lot. Sometimes it can be pain, but sometimes it could be simply as, I know that I'm dying and I don't know what to do about my cat. You know, like, it could be just simple everyday life things. Yeah. And that's the most important thing to them. They might have awful pain and awful nausea or something like that, but that is their biggest thing.
And that's come up a lot. What am I going to do with my cat or my dog? And that worry that I'm going to leave them behind and nobody's going to care for them, that's a big deal.
Mm.
And not to be taken lightly.
Yeah. I had a lady a while ago who, you know, had her diagnosis and then she was getting sicker and sicker and she was really, she had a lot of nausea and vomiting and couldn't get on top of it very well. And she had this cat that she dearly loved, but he was getting old, really old, and she just didn't want him to go anywhere to anyone else. And then so she actually decided to have him put down. And she said, when I spoke to her a couple of weeks later, I said, how are you going? She said, I'm amazing. She said, that was the best thing. She said, I know this sounds really weird and really awful, but I knew he was too old to go to somebody else. And so putting him down, she said, it's made such a difference to me. She wasn't vomiting, and you know, like she still had a little bit of vomiting, but it was nothing like what she had.
So she was actually quite deeply burdened.
Yeah, she was. She was deeply burdened
by
that.
By worry and anxiety.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's why I talk about the medicalisation. We can quickly jump to medications. You know, fix this, fix that, fix that. That's what I mean by that. And yet, you know, what else is there? Because that made the hugest difference to her. When I saw her, I couldn't get over her. She was like a young girl.
So this is part of your job, is to find out what are the other underlying issues besides the medical issues.
Yes, that's
so that's
right.
What your job is.
Yeah. Well, it is really. You can't avoid it, because if I don't get to that, then I might be treating that person in a certain way, but they might. It's not going to work for them if these underlying things aren't addressed, you know. It's a complex job. Like, it's. I know every day I go out to work, I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't mind that. I've never been averse to change or anything like that. So, but, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, my gosh, how do I deal with this? But you just have to kind of stop and breathe and connect back to yourself. Because that's the other thing, not to fall into what's going on for other people. If I do that, I'm in the sea with them. None of us are going to be getting any clarity on what to do, you know. It's like being friends of mine have talked about this. It's like being the lighthouse. So you're there, you know, the lighthouse is there, and you might throw out a what do you call them, a little life buoy or something, and then bring them in that way. But to jump in there with them, that's not going to help anybody. Because I can't swim very well, so we're both going to drown, you know.
And I guess
so. It's to stay clear, keep coming back to me, and getting clear on what's happening, and then what's next.
And I guess over the 20 years you've been doing this job, you've learned from your experiences.
I have,
too,
and I've learned from my failures. You know,
yeah.
I've had a few of those, and I've missed things sometimes. You know, as we all do, and. You know, you certainly learn from those things, but you also learn from the joy and the beauty of what's going on for some people when they kind of realise, gosh, you know, because way back before assisted dying was even a thing, people would say, oh, we know, if you wouldn't do this, you know, you wouldn't make a dog suffer like I'm suffering, you know, and if I could do it, I would have it, you know, and then, you know, I'd sometimes say, well. You know, what about now, you know? Let's see what we can do for you now to make sure that things are right from between now and whatever that time is for you. And some of those people have said, when they've got right to that end point, I'm quite glad that didn't happen, actually, because I wouldn't have had this happen with my sister, or that happen with my, you know, I wouldn't have actually known how much my family loved me, you know. So I'm not saying anything against a sister dying or anything like that, but I remember those times with people saying that to me, and
And of course, it can work the other way as well.
Once absolutely.
People have made that decision to die, that's when.
That's fine, and it's important.
All the resolution and goodbyes happen as well.
Yeah, that's right.
We did do an episode in the first series about assisted dying, and one of the sad things for me was, but the two cases we talked about, a lot of it was shrouded in secrecy because of. They didn't want relatives who had very fixed ideas against it to know. So it had to be done in a very quiet, surreptitious way, which is unfortunate.
It is
that,
sad.
That others can't accept. You've made a decision and others will not accept
that's
that decision.
Right. Because that's your choice, you know. And we have to respect people's choices and support them as much as they need until that time happens for them, because they're still alive. They still need palliative care. They still need that support. And that's another thing for the government to kind of look at, I think. Palliative care is needed whether you have assisted dying or not. And it's so important to not write people off at the end of their life and think, oh, palliative care, that doesn't matter, those people are dying. Well, no. It does matter. It totally matters. You know, those people have been people who've worked for this country, worked to keep this country going, and you know, but they should be valued. No.
Jeanette, as we're finishing up, do you have anything you'd like to say, a reflection or some words of wisdom, something that you'd like to pass on about what you've learned?
I can't think of anything at the moment, but
I'll put you on the spot.
Just to be with, just simply being with people and being supporting them to be with themselves with whatever they're going through, to understand that what's happening today may be just a blip, and it may not happen tomorrow. And but also that you know, people have, as we're going through our dying process, people are having little deaths along the way. You know, they can't drive their car anymore, they can't go to bowls anymore, you know, they may not be able to get out of bed anymore. You know, there's all these things that happen all along the way, and it's like a little reflection for us all the way through that, you know, that we're in a cycle, and cycles end, you know, they change, they go round and round, and so this cycle is, you're in a cycle, so just simply be with it as much as you can and not fight it somehow. That feels a bit wonky, what I just said.
Not at all. It's very clear.
I think it's like, for me, I've had to learn to be just very present with myself in my life, so that I am present for other people. And whenever I'm not present, things go wonky. So just come back, make sure I'm really solid with just driving, even, you know, just driving. Not switch off when I'm driving, not forget about that, because driving, you know, there's beauty everywhere. Look around. Keeps you fresh for your next patient. Mm. When I was working in Tauranga, I had a new patient who I went and saw, and he was quite an angry man. And it was a little bit tricky getting his history and everything and explaining to him what we could support him with and all of that. And then he ended up in hospital the next day, and then he came out, and I went and saw him as soon as he came out of hospital. And he was, like, violently angry. And it wasn't with me. Like, he was angry at everything. He was angry because he had cancer and that he was dying, but he was taking it out on everything. And I actually had to say to him, I'm sorry, I can't, you know, the way you're behaving, I will have to leave. And because he was walking around ranting and, you know, going to throw things and everything. And I left, and I got in my car, and I started shaking like crazy. and I thought, oh, my gosh, I can't go and see another person yet. So I rang my boss and said what had happened. And she was gorgeous, and she said, what are you going to do now? And I said, actually, I think I might go to the nearest park and just go for a walk in the park. She said, yeah, you do that, she said, do that. So I got out of my car, I walked across the park, and I thought, I'll go to that tree, which was quite a long way across the park. And when I got there, as I was getting there, I saw all these monarch butterflies. And when I got to the tree, it was covered in monarch butterflies. And I was just amazed, and then they were all just fluttering around. And so I stood there in wonder for quite a few minutes. And then I went, wow, all that's gone. All that stuff that guy, you know, attacked me with is gone. And so I went to my next patient feeling like myself again, totally present. None of that came with me to that person. If I'd gone straight there, you know, they wouldn't have got a very good consultation, because I would have been carrying that. And they would have been wondering, was that anything to do with them, or, you know what I mean? I think everybody feels everything all of the time, yet we bury it a lot. So it's really important to be present, to be as still and connected as you can to yourself, so you can be that like that with other people.
Did you see that patient again?
I did, and he'd kind of settled down by then, and so it was actually not so bad to be able to go and be with him. So, you know, I didn't have to leave. You know, he was actually able to. So, yeah. Thank you very much, Andrew. It's been very beautiful talking to you.
Thank you, Jeanette.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.